Hello and welcome to your weekly dose of the latest sustainability fun news, facts and reviews brought to you by the Green Elephant. This week, Bill Gates tells us the five things we need to know about the climate crisis. IKEA plans to make its furniture last forever. We speak to Kate August from My Apparel and a fast tyre change for the Michelin Man. Joining me to discuss these and more as usual is Russell. Good morning, Russell.
Morning, Mike. Hold on. You're not calling me the Michelin Man in this particular context, are you?
Well, how fast can you change a tyre?
Well, I certainly got rid of a few tyres in the last few years.
Okay,
but...
Spare ones that you had hanging around.
Yeah, my waist.
Yeah. Also coming up are our February Education Challenge, the news, and a fashion-based fact or fake. We'll also be talking about Norway, Russia, Tanzania, Old Spice, Coke, Lego, Shell, Bitcoin, batteries, Berlin, steak, turbines, ice, coins, carbon, and chickens. So, in his new book, How to Avoid a Climate Disaster, billionaire Bill Gates shares five basic concepts that have helped to frame his understanding of the pending climate crisis. But Gates has begun to develop a mental framework, he calls it, organized around five concepts. He says these are complex subjects that can be confusing. This framework will help you cut through the clutter. So, Russell, I'm very much looking forward to cutting through the clutter because I think, you know, as we demonstrate on the show every week, there's a lot of clutter out there in the world.
There is. Yeah. And to be honest, in my first read of this, because it is a fairly long article, which we'll post a link to in the show page, but then his position is quite interesting and he's probably more aligned to ours than perhaps other parties, may I say.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think, yes, I mean, let's skip through the five points that he makes. Firstly, he says that there are 51 billion tons of greenhouse gases are added to the atmosphere each year. And if you've seen our glossary post on greenhouse gases, you'll know that it's not all bad. Water vapor is a greenhouse gas. That's not bad stuff. I think, you know, 51 billion tons of the bad types of greenhouse gases, I think is what
I think that's what he's referring to. Yeah.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Number two, making things like cement and steel is more of a culprit than cars or jets.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting one, that, because he does give some statistics with regards to that. He says making things like cement, steel, and plastic, 31% of the greenhouse gases, electricity, 27%. And then he makes a comment. Obviously, he's got a little bit of a bone in his throat about Elon Musk and Tesla.
Maybe.
Of course, they use steel in their productions and then use electricity. So they're actually the worst offender.
Great. On the power, he says it takes 5,000 gigawatts to power the world and gives a breakdown of cities and countries, I think.
I think it was good. 5,000 gigawatts the world, 1,000 gigawatts the states, which kind of puts them in context a bit.
Yeah.
Mid-sized city, 1 gigawatt, small town, 1 megawatt, and an average household, 1 kilowatt. My feeling was 1 kilowatt for a house is a lot.
Yeah.
24 hours at 1 kilowatt
But it does say the average American household.
Yeah. So, oh, careful.
Clearly.
We have got Americans in our herd, remember?
We do. But we've got a story on Tanzania later. I suspect the average Tanzanian household is not a kilowatt.
Yeah. Kilowatt year.
He says, number four, some power sources take up more space. I guess solar farms are, you know, need a lot of land area. And number five, it's kind of obvious, really, but I guess it's, you know, needs stating. It all comes back to money. And
there's one of the richest people in the world. And it's quite an interesting stance, I think. Yeah. And to be honest, he's just saying stuff that's right.
He is. But I think, you know, what this made me think is we come on the show and we have conversations every day with people about climate change and environment and energy and global warming and all these issues. And I would say that probably 70% of the conversations I find myself having are around sustainable swaps and vegan diets and, you know, eco-friendly tips for living a better domestic life. And
yeah.
And actually, that, not saying that's not important, but it really misses the big stuff that is going to make the real difference in this story, really. And the five things he outlines here are the big things that are going to make the real difference. You know, great, swap your shampoo or don't use shampoo. That's great. But is that going to be one of the big things that makes the real difference? And actually, not making cement is probably, on a global scale, is probably going to have a much bigger dent in the issue than is, you know, everybody moving to, you know,
a
whatever
vegan diet or
sustainable option it is. So
yeah.
I think it's a really interesting perspective. And I think it's something we should, you know, talk more about on this show. Is we mention balance a lot.
Yeah.
And we talk about taking small steps as being important. That is all important, but some small steps are obviously more important than other small steps because they make a bigger difference.
Yeah, and we've got a story later on about building with wood, haven't we? Or a fair bit on wood this week.
Yeah.
But you know, it's some of these major changes. But I think the balance problem has been this: that you focus on what you can do something about, and there's small change in that thing, and you perceivably think, I can't change this, and then when you actually look at it, is actually changing it any better? Because it's and I think what we've said is sustainability is a bigger story. It's not all about food. It's not all about plastic waste. It's not all about it. There's people considerations. There's space considerations. There's water pollution, there's water usage, there's so much aspects to what we consume. It's not just one thing.
And I think we've been fairly prevalent on Clubhouse, which is the new kid on the social media block, but it has hundreds of thousands of people on there having conversations every day about sustainability. And what I've noticed, the trend there, are the two topics that are getting the most conversation are fashion, fast fashion, changing our clothing habits, and oceans and ocean plastic. And
yes,
absolutely those need addressing. Absolutely they do. But nobody is really having the conversation around, what does big business have to change? What do energy companies need to do? What do we need to do differently in our
cement,
steel building things? Yeah. What do we need to do differently in terms of the power source choices we make? You know, solar may not be the panacea that we think it is. And those conversations they are happening in small niche corners, but they're not getting the airtime that plastic and fashion is. So it's a really interesting story from our friend Mr. Gates. And we you know, it's we couldn't go an episode without mentioning Microsoft or its connections in one way or another. Yeah. So there it is.
Yeah.
We've squeezed it in there.
It would be the most bizarrest of all things that Microsoft, that's taken so much slack in the business world for 30, 40 years, their leader then turns around and helps us revolutionize climate change. Yeah. However, I think he's talking about the right things. I'm kind of intrigued as to reading the book now, How to Avoid a Climate Disaster. Maybe that's one for the bookshelf.
We'll put that a link to the book in the show page. Mm. So our February challenge now, and we have been explaining some basic sustainability terms over the past few weeks, and moving on, we're going to explain a few more this week, and we've chosen an interesting selection this week, and good luck rustling coming to a definition on one of the ones that I've given you.
Thanks for that, Mike. Yeah.
You're very welcome. So starting off, deforestation, and a story we feature a lot, and something that has many different meanings, but by deforestation, we mean, and we think the best definition is, the clearing or thinning of forests by humans and converting the land to any non-forest use. And because, you know, in practice, you clear the land and that completely destroys the forest. And in some cases, even partial logging or a bit of forest fires or thinning out of that forest changes it dramatically. And I think the other key point is it's the loss of that forest, but then it's the changing of the use to something whether it's grazing, agriculture, whatever that use is of that land, or even construction, it's a non-forest use. So that's, you know, deforestation.
Yeah, especially when they head off to monocrops and things like that, which cause it dreadful damage.
And I think it's, you know, it's important, not just that it's not just clearing, you know, the thinning and the fires can have the same effect as clearing. So that's important to bear in mind.
Yeah, well, that kind of takes us neatly on, because the forests are part of an ecosystem, and the ecosystem is fairly well defined. It is an area on a planet where animals and other living things combined with non-living elements such as soil, water, and climate to form a dependent system, and there are, you know. The world that we live on, the Earth, is not the only ecosystem, and there are ecosystems within ecosystems.
Yeah.
We live down in Cornwall in the UK, and we have an ecosystem called the Eden Project, worldwide famous, where they've created an ecosystem which can live within itself. So it doesn't have to mean the whole world, but it does, as well as everything else. So, and the big problem with an ecosystem is it only takes a small change. Perhaps the butterfly effect has been used in terms of a temporal impact, but we change one thing, like taking a predator out of the mix because we don't like wolves eating our children. Yeah. And then all of a sudden the cascade down the chain means something runs riot.
Because bringing hippos to Colombia.
Yeah,
I love that story
of how breaking an ecosystem can happen just with the zoo.
Yeah, all those interdependencies. Now, I drew a short straw here, but not the shortest of straws. So our next term is eco-friendly, and what an interesting term, and it is used ubiquitously everywhere. And the best definition we could come up with for eco-friendly was a vague, non-specific term with the Latin origin meaning house, commonly used to refer to activities which don't harm the environment. And I think really, if you're going to be speaking about environmental issues or climate or anything else, I think you should avoid this term if you can, because when you say eco-friendly, the person you're saying it to may understand something different. And they may take a different meaning from what you're saying. So I think it's a term to be avoided. Find a different specific term to use if you can. So eco-friendly, great, but not a term that we will be using if we can avoid it.
If we can avoid it. And thanks for this, Mike. Mike gave me the lovely definition of green. And green, not in respect to the colour. All colour is its basis, of course. We define this as the vaguest and most abused term in the environmental movement. It can mean anything and be used to provide mixed messages. So we've heard more and more through the press words like green washing, which is take a whitewash, which was a popular way of covering over a crappy building, to greenwashing, which is a dreadful way of covering over crappy business practices or selling something short. But green is something to do with environmentalism, because green, we think of grass, we think of trees, we think of plants when we think of green. And that's at the core of it. It's really that natural world. And then, but we put greens in front of something like green petrol, or green CO2, it just doesn't work. But somebody will do it at some point. In fact, I've just done it.
You've just done it. The green elephant.
I produce green CO2. You're the green elephant, which don't exist. And oh my goodness, have we got to change the name to, I don't know, an eco-friendly elephant?
I like this. It generally refers to something or other to do with climate, or maybe environmentalism, or perhaps planet, or maybe even people. And again, is global warming green? And what about sustainability?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just so vague and so confusing that, again.
I'd love to hear anybody's comments on green, whether we should eliminate it from our vocabulary altogether.
Absolutely.
But although I quite like having a green elephant, because they are unique. Yeah,
they are unique. But listeners, what do you think green means? We've told you what we think. So IKEA has ambitious plans to make its cheap furniture last forever. Now, I think we all have first-hand experience of IKEA furniture.
Good and bad.
To erase its massive climate footprint, and it is massive. I saw it was like 0.1% of the world's carbon. It was just vast, you know.
Yeah.
So IKEA, and then you've got 999 other things that produce more carbon.
999.9. So, yeah.
Countries and organizations and IKEA, you know, does vast amount itself. But so it needs to change what it's doing, how it makes things, how you buy things, and it's got, I love this. This is we talk about a greenwashing in a term. IKEA's overarching goal is to become climate positive by 2030. Well, I think I'm quite positive about climate, and I've done it this week. Climate's a really good thing. I really like it.
I've seen this a couple of times. They aren't the first to use the phrase climate positive. I've seen carbon positive as well. And ooh. I kind of go, well, surely you don't want to be carbon positive and a carbon negative. But I mean, yeah, it's a phrase I think that people don't want to be carbon negative. They want to be something. They want to be positive. It's all marketeers winning the story here.
But actually, there is some detail behind this story in that they want to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, and they want to reduce more than its entire value chain emits. So that's an interesting thing, how they're going to measure it. But it's still intending to grow the number of stores it has, design more products, move new markets. So that's an interesting challenge for it. So it's going to look at its materials and its goal is to use only recycled or renewable materials in its 9,500 products by 2030. And that's a challenge because today only 10% of their products contain recycled materials.
They have come up with some new technologies to perhaps do that, like the new form of laminating woods, which make it almost as strong as steel, and we'll come on to another story on that in a minute, won't we?
And the interesting thing was, it's not just its furniture, because I wasn't really aware of it, but IKEA is one of the world's largest food sellers. It has 680 million customers visit its food outlets, that was last year, and it sells 1 billion meatballs a year.
Yeah,
1 billion meatballs.
Yeah, they're so very tasty.
It's looking at moving plant-based and you know, using non-red meat, and you know, within 5 years going plant-based. So they've got a lot of
I mean, this is a long article that we'll link to in the Huffington Post. It is thorough. They have embraced some good stuff. We've seen them. We've reported on the fact they're now taking back your old IKEA furniture and turning their business into a circular business. They'll try and reuse it, and they're pushing hard on that. And they're trying to find new things to create. Their store footprints are ginormous. So in terms of what space they take up on Earth, they're trying to address that by creating more compact stores. So they've shrunk a store. I like this one in New York City because they have so many people traveled. Half the people in New York City travel by the underground, or what we call the underground. They call the
subway,
the public transportation, or buses. And so they've created a store where a lot of the stuff inside is stuff you can carry away with you instead of having to have a car to load up with giant furniture. That's good. We bought an IKEA sofa when we moved to a smaller house. We had to downsize our sofa as well, and we bought an IKEA sofa, very comfy, but it comes with a 25-year guarantee, which is brilliant for the frame. And then the covers of all the different things you buy, you can buy again, and they're quite cost effective. So if you want to change color, so you could be buying a sofa for life. So these are the kind of things we need to think about.
The challenge here though is, And it's good to see IKEA making all these announcements, and there's a long list of announcements.
It's massive.
But in an organization with such a vast footprint as IKEA, you can have a long list of announcements that barely make a dent in what you're doing,
yeah,
and in what your suppliers are doing. So what I'd kind of be keen to see over the next few years is how big of a dent have all these initiatives made, because the cynic in me says that the dent might not be as large as we would hope it to be.
No, I mean, becoming climate positive would suggest they're going to have to be climate carbon neutral by 2040 or 2050, depending. Oh, no, they're saying 2030. So, I mean, they're going to have to move fast.
They are.
And to be honest, we should see this. We should be able to, it should be visible. They're a big company. I mean, now, what was that, 530 stores in 50 countries? And they have planted 3 million trees across 31,000 acres of the rainforest. But we know that has a two-side to it. We're not completely sold on the mass planting of trees and then sequestering carbon.
Yeah, 3 million trees versus how many they need to make their furniture.
It's probably north
of 3 million a year.
And then half of those die in the first 20 years, and they don't become carbon effective until 20 years old. It goes back to dear old Bill Gates. It's so complex, but if we can focus on some perhaps key things, they're taking up a lot of space on Earth and they're shoving a lot of carbon out into the atmosphere. So maybe those two things, if they can do that, maybe we can salute them later on the show.
So let's take a look at some other big sustainability news stories from the week. And first up, Norway. How did they become the number one in electric vehicles? And interesting article that says that's got a breakdown of the market share of electric vehicles sold across the world in 2019. And we thought China was looking good and growing, but 5% of all electric vehicles sold in China, 23% sold in Iceland, but 56% of new electric vehicles were sold in Norway, which was a surprising statistic for me.
In fact, the Nordic countries are way ahead of everybody else, Iceland, Netherlands, Sweden and Finland. By the time you add them up, you're looking at 90%. It's like 80% of the world's electric vehicles are being sold in one region.
But what they've done is that they've incentivized it through people's bank accounts in their pockets. They've said, you don't have to pay any road tax. We won't have you paid import tax. We'll give you some scrappage fees. We won't charge you VAT. And so generally we'll make electric vehicles financially more appealing than gas cars. And so people are saying, well, we'll buy those then because they're cheaper. That's how you make electric vehicles more popular, make them cheaper. Yeah.
And we know, I mean, it came back to 0.5 and Bill Gates. Oh, my goodness, I'm going to be referencing him all the time, aren't I?
You are.
It comes down to money. And if we can save us money, we're far more likely to do the right thing.
Yep.
Yeah. It's a good story and some good illustrations of what exactly they've done there. And, of course, they too have also invested heavily in getting the infrastructure out, as we know. It's about how fast can you charge and how can you make sure that people can travel to where they need to get to, because they've got some challenging areas of the world to travel through. So they need to make sure that these people can stop and recharge and make sure they don't run out of juice halfway up a mountain somewhere. Don't have many mountains, do they? Anyway.
Yeah, so moving on.
Yeah, sorry.
New Merris, I don't know where Russell had gone. He'd obviously gone.
I'd gone off on there. I had a moment reading a very long article. So, go back and read that. I'm 2 points on this one. US and Russia have got together at last.
I know, surprising.
A new maritime pollution agreement regarding the Bering Sea, which is the very thin bit of sea that runs between the America and Alaska. And you don't realize how close those two countries are until you see that on the map. So they've got together and they're patrolling this area land to make sure that they can enforce fishery law and obviously stop pollution entering into the Arctic Circle. I find it a tad ironic because obviously these things are hammering around, patrolling a piece of land or ice in many occasions, a bit of sea, in diesel-powered ships, and then flying over planes so they can capture people that are perhaps fishing or polluting in the wrong way. But yeah. It's one of those balanced things. It's great. Couldn't we do this with satellite?
Possibly, but I guess, you know, cooperation between US and Russia is good. Important.
And they are trying to protect a really valuable resource from our perspective, but surely it's a better way than running ships up and down it all the time.
Tanzania now, and talking about going up and down, Tanzanian government have approved a cable car to go up Kilimanjaro. So quite apart from the altitude sickness you might get if you go up in a cable car up Kilimanjaro that quickly. There are issues with, and we talked about ecosystems and biodiversity. There's issues on, there's a lot of porters and guides and things whose livelihood, relies on people wanting to go up and down the mountain. So it's an interesting one that the government have approved something which has a lot of environmental and social negatives, really. So,
can you imagine how much it would cost to climb? What was it, 10,000 feet in a cable car? It'd be an impressive engineering feat, if nothing else. But yeah, getting mountain sickness. The only thing they said about altitude sickness is it tends to kick in 6 to 12 hours after you've reached an altitude. So that's why you end up having to amble down. They probably won't spend the time up there, but. To be honest, if I wanted to get to the summit of Kilimanjaro and shout about it, I'd want to walk it. I want 7 days worth of photos, not one hour.
Quick up and down, though. No.
Yeah, it's a bit nasty. Okay, so far more mundane things now. Casting my mind back to Old Spice adverts of the 1970s and 80s. And I didn't even realize they were still around, but Secret and Old Spice are launching refillable antiperspirant cases. And they're going to offering aluminium-free deodorants in recyclable paper tube packaging as well. So, I mean, that's a short story. But
just following the example of Dove we had a few weeks ago, and I guess we're going to see more and more of these. So.
We are.
Good. Another quick one. Coke has decided it's going to have 100% recycled plastic bottles in the US. All I want to say is about time too.
Following your video of picking up what looked like a Coke lid on a beach in Cornwall that had been cleaned only 2 weeks earlier. I can get that. Yeah. Although recycled waste on the plastic waste on the seashore is not much better, is it? Talking of plastics, Lego, as we've heard on many occasions before, they're moving away from plastic and they're going to create a brand called the Botanical Garden or the Botanical Collection. To give children and adults a touch of nature using a plant-based plastic. Fascinating. Yeah, and what they've found is that research found that 81% of adults around the world found that play helps them to relax or de-stress, while 73% of adults look for unique ways to de-stress weekly. And this is different. This is not your traditional range of Lego. They've done some clever stuff. They've got one bouquet of flowers and a bonsai. It's different. I'll give them it's different. I think it's probably more aimed at the adult market, possibly.
We'll see how
see how popular and
biodegradable it is.
Oh yeah, rotter Lego.
Well, I was speaking to somebody the other day who said they had a biodegradable plastic carrier bag, biodegradable. They had it in a jar of seawater and it had been there for 8 years and it still hadn't broken down. So maybe we'll do the same with a piece of Lego.
Perhaps we can have a collection of all sorts of stuff.
Shell now is saying that you need a Brazil-sized forest needed to meet the 1.5-degree Paris climate goal. And Shell is saying that it's released a pathway showing how the world could potentially meet that that pathway. It says itself it's going to go ahead for peak oil in 2025 and peak gas a decade later. But again, you know, they've described their pathway as a truly desirable destination and that Shell is going to play its part, and other such warm phrases, but
yeah,
very little concrete okay. here from Shell that says that they're really going to step forwards on this one.
And I guess you're coming back to, is this back to the trees again? I mean, I'm all for, you know, having more forestation and green cover, and that's all great. But if it's all about the trees, it's probably not going to be fast enough. Back on cars again, Jaguar, who are owned by India's Tata Motors, I've announced that Land Rover's luxury Jaguar brand will be entirely, easy for me to say, electric by 2025. And they'll have its entire lineup by 2030. Mm. So there's another target for Bill Gates instead of Tesla, I suppose. But it's quick and it's, you know, it's probably the right thing. Let's get them from electric to something that's perhaps other fueled. But hey,
I'm all for ambition. If companies want to say 2025 or whatever, that's good, better than 2030. And Tesla's come up quite a few times in today's show. Tesla, they announced that they bought 1.5 billion Bitcoin. I think that was in the last couple of weeks. And that they're going to accept Bitcoin as payment if you want to buy a new Tesla. But there's a problem. Because of the way Bitcoin works, you have to have tens of thousands of computers churning away constantly to discover the keys needed for these things and to mine
them,
Bitcoins. It uses a huge amount of energy. And apparently as much energy as the country of Argentina is what Bitcoin is needed. 121.36 terawatt hours a year to mine Bitcoin. So it uses more energy than the Netherlands or the UAE and Argentina. So,
well, with a guy like Elon Musk who's owns what's he got? Solar Winds, I think he's the other company he owns, which is solar generation. Maybe he doesn't feel so bad about it, but So I'm kind of intrigued on that story as I read it as to what does it cost to run our share markets as well. So in comparison, how bad is it? Moving on, we have hills that can generate electricity. We spoke about hydroelectric on our social post recently, didn't we? Is hydroelectric a forgotten renewable power? Now, it does take up a tremendous amount of space. When you do hydroelectric power generation, it requires a reservoir. You might end up pumping water up back into the reservoir, depending on how fast it has from natural water flow. When electricity is cheaper, they pump it back up, and it's always been a bit of a problem it can't be downsized much to make it far more portable. But they've come up with a far denser high density hydro, which can be buried in a small hill essentially, so it wouldn't stick out like fields of solar panels and giant wind farms, and it potentially could deliver the same amount as a conventional hydropower, but in probably a quarter of the size. So they've mapped out 9,500 sites in the UK alone with hills that could accommodate the technology. So it could be we're spreading it without ruining with a giant reservoir or anything like that. Could be completely buried, but we'll see.
And perhaps on top of each of those hills, we could build one of the new 98 meter tall skyscrapers that they're planning to build in Berlin, entirely made of wood. So Bill Gates again says we need less concrete than steel. This uses cross-laminated timbers instead of steel to build really tall towers. So that's a really interesting initiative and concept. I'm not sure I want to live on the top floor of a timber skyscraper, but hey,
Again, it's this laminated technology which uses less wood and actually takes up less space than steel. Mm. And if you ever, you know, I know you haven't been to New York, have you? But you I see have, the yeah, Flatiron yeah. Building, which was one of the, if not the first steel built buildings at 13 stories high.
Yeah,
and because buildings would collapse under the weight of their own bricks. Mm. And when they were building traditionally, of course, this is one step further. It's fascinating. It'd be great to see it. And they call it, I liked it. They called it the anti-Amazon tower because Amazon are building a very controversial commercial building in East Berlin, aren't they? So that's, well, I go on to a subject that both of us have ummed and ahed about, and we've made many a comment on this, but we have the world's first 3D printed ribeye steak in front of me, not literally in a picture. And apparently you can eat it and it's tender and juicy as the real thing. That's the story. That's so it looks a bit, they've said it's near, they've managed to make it now fattier.
I'd be interested to get some feedback from the listeners on this one, because we had a kind of a mixed view on the lab grown chicken. It'd be interesting to see if there's a mixed view on this one, because the lab grown chicken, I might be tempted to give that a go. I think this one, I'm not feeling the love for the lab-grown steak, I'll be honest.
Yeah, well, we've got an issue in a story in a second, which this kind of buys into. So, yeah.
Anyway.
Lovely.
Problems in the south of the USA. cold weather, frozen wind turbines have caused blackouts and leave more than 1 million Texans without power as the capacity is reduced to 50%. So, renewable energy is great until it's not.
Yeah.
And I guess this is one of the issues, and we talked about this as one of the issues and trends for 2021 is storage. How are you going to store this stuff? We can generate it, but when it gets frozen and stops working, you need a store to draw it from somewhere.
I think that was what was interesting about the hydropower solution, was that it could draw energy and essentially store it in fluids that are stored at a high level ready for hydro, which could be turned on and off. So that's interesting. I mean, isn't that incredibly odd weather for Texas?
Yeah.
I don't know. So maybe Texans should just realize that their years of taking oil out of the ground has now left us with a very freak weather. Yep. Going back to our plant-based meats and our other things that are produced to kind of fake our meat addiction in our world, is that Oxford scientists have now said that these plant-based meats produce the same amount of CO2 emission as producing a chicken. And it had to be. I mean, you don't get away without having to do some kind of massive amount of process, which uses power and whatever chemicals you might have to do to create this plant-based meat emulsified into something that tastes like it. It's bound to take an overhead.
Every activity you do produces CO2 in some kind, which is where the next story might help, because, you know, how do you reduce those carbon creating activities? Well, there's a really interesting article here on Mashable actually about carbon coins. So the concept is that organizations and people get given carbon coins for not producing carbon. So your big oil companies leave the stuff in the ground and we'll give you some carbon coins, and those carbon coins will be bought by governments, bought and sold on currency exchanges, and so we'll gain a value. And because they gain a value, there's money to be made. And so people will be interested in them. And I think it's a really interesting concept that if you can create this carbon coin, and I imagine it will be some sort of cryptocurrency.
Yeah.
That will...
which would use CO2. They wouldn't mine it though, would they?
Will, see a growth in this sort of thing and incentivize people to do the right thing. Because a lot of these initiatives and stories we talk about, they rely on the goodwill of people and companies to do the right thing.
Yeah.
Whereas this wouldn't rely on their goodwill. It would rely on their greed and their money earning tendencies to do the right thing. So
to grab that coin and then trade
probably
off.
Needs both.
It does. And now back into our ecosystem definition that we had earlier, the great white sharks, or the subjects of Jaws and many other movies of its type, have been fleeing to different waters because of the change in the temperature of the ocean. So that previously the coast of California waters were too cold to have a great white shark in it. Bad luck, California isn't anymore. The downside is they've killed all the sea otters in Monterey Bay. I've been to Monterey Bay. It's absolutely lovely. Lots of seals, lots of tasty wildlife for a great white shark, except they're not supposed to be there. And so it will have a devastating effect on that ecosystem just because the oceans are getting warmer.
Yep. And that's the end of the news for the week. So today I'm really, really pleased to welcome onto the show Kate August from My Apparel. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
No, you're very welcome. I'm really pleased you're here. And we're going to talk about Kate's brand shop, My Apparel, in a second. But Kate, tell us a little bit about what brought you to start a kind of a sustainable fashion brand.
Well, taking it back from the beginning, really, I suppose I've been in the industry now for over 20 years. It's all I've ever known. And I used to be a fast fashion buyer, and I've worked with some amazing luxury brands. And then I had children, and then I saw like the kind of the consumption of clothes that they went through in quick succession, you know, they grow, you know, even clothes that they haven't had time to fit in.
Yep.
And they still got the tags on.
And the shoes, they grow out of them before they've worn them almost, don't they?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And sometimes they get shoes and they don't even fit because they're just odd. They're just kids' size shoes, feet before the age of like 5. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it was just a case of like watching these mountain of clothes like grow.
Mm.
And then I think also during that time, I kind of took some time off and to kind of, you know, did some like self-discovery, I suppose you could say. And I started Netflix as well, and I'm always looking for a fashion documentary, and I watched True Cost.
Okay.
And I think that was the very first, it's probably naive to say, we knew what was going on, but didn't know what was going on when you're doing orders and when you're producing garments from a buyer's point of view.
Yeah. Did you see any of those kind of practices when you were working with, you know, the fast fashion brands, or was it kind of something that happened somewhere else?
It was just nothing was spoke about, you know, as long as our margins were high and we were, you know, everything was done on phone and
doing the numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. And there was no discussion about who would make them back in those days, 20 years ago. You know, I worked with a fast fashion brand, and you know, I think the audit kind of process was you didn't know as a buyer to go and audit your factories.
Yeah.
You know, you stuck to what you know and how they work. Because at the time, the company I worked for was a Philip Green company.
Right.
So bearing in mind, he had other companies, therefore he had his supplier base already.
Yeah.
And you're just using those supplier bases and carrying on and moving them on to each brand and head office.
Yeah. And 20 years is a long time in sustainability. I certainly wasn't asking any of these questions 20 years ago and wasn't even aware. And I guess, you know, most people were the same 20 years ago.
Absolutely. And I think, I don't know, when I saw the video and you know, you actually saw it unfold, you kind of get a bit of a, oh God, I was part of that. You know, I have been part of that, and I don't even know what I've been part of.
Yeah.
And I think what happened was I kind of went down like the rabbit hole of then Googling all the people that was on the video and what they did and their background and so on and so forth. And I was then in a position where I wanted to kind of do something for myself. And I realized that at the end of the day, people still wanted to buy new. So my come was kind of like, well, if they're going to buy new, they have to buy better. Yeah. So I then started to research brands that were doing better. And I got to the point where I didn't want to shop at Zara anymore and Topshop anymore. I was getting to an age where my 20-year-old cousin was walking through the doors, you know, and she was wearing the same top as me. And I was like, this is going to change. You just realize how old you were. And it's like, I started researching all these amazing brands out there that you kind of like pop the bubble and you realize there's so much more out there when it comes to fashion and clothing, not just like your, you know, being on the treadmill and where everyone else is shopping.
So My Apparel, and that's MI for listeners, so they can find it, and we'll do some links on the show page later. But My Apparel it's an online clothing shop, and it's got a couple of other things there, but clothing online, and it's clothing from a number of brands. And you said you were looking for better brands, and I'm interested in what better means for you.
For me, better brands is people that know their supply chain, know where their fabric comes from, how they treat their culture of their own head office, as well as the culture of who they are having their goods manufactured by. And I would go to Berlin twice a year to trade shows and actually talk to the owners and the founders. And if the owners and the founders were on the stand talking to you, you get a sense of the passion through their eyes. And I think that is, there is also an element of trust.
Yep.
But it's kind of like, right, well, how can you produce this? If they easily can produce everything, then there's no kind of, there's a transparency, which is important. Mm. And I think it's also important that I think brands of that certain criteria in the sustainable arena is the fact that they're honest and open when things aren't going 100% for them. So they're like, we're working on it. We know that we need to change this, so we're working on it.
Yeah.
Things can't be changed overnight. It does take time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if we can, you can always kind of like change like small things down to like your couriers and so on and so forth, which is really easy. And how you bag and wrap a product ready to go into the post, you know, you can change all that to be plastic free.
Yeah.
But when it comes to your actual supply chain, it can be a little bit more difficult because it does take a lot of research. And
so, so you know, you find brands that fit with your, you know, ethos and your approach and things. And then what do you do in terms of, you know, evaluating those? Because as you say, there are more and more brands coming onto the market that, you know, purport to have sustainable credentials. But as we discuss on the show every week, that's not all. That's sometimes quite surface and doesn't go very deep. And so, how do you assess whether it is, does truly fit with you rather than just they're saying some of the right things?
Yeah, I know. I mean, again, it's hard and it's a balance. And like I said, it is trust as well. And I think the more you're in the arena, the more you kind of you're learning all the time as you go. Mm. So for example, I had actually dropped two brands I was stocking during the time. And I've only been open 2.5 years. It's really not that long. But in that time, I have actually dropped two brands that I wouldn't stockhold, because I stockhold, I don't drop ship. So I invest and I buy into the brand because I found that they were on certain platforms where they didn't care who it was. It was just a brand to them that they were selling, and it had a sustainable aspect on it. But when it came to things like marking down for sale, I couldn't match that kind of, you know, it was below cost, as it were, I was just wondering where the ethos kind of came from those brands for them to be so big and to lose the discussion of why they started in the first place.
Yeah.
So it's trial and error, and it's trial and error, it's trust, and you learn, you're just learning as you go on, and you can hold your hand up and say, I made a mistake, I've moved on. And
absolutely, we make mistakes all the time. We're famous for being imperfect and failing at things. But
well, that's what we need to remember.
Absolutely.
I always say perfection is a myth. So
So why not pick a couple of brands and tell listeners about, you know, the brands, the sort of clothing outfits that they do and what they can expect when they visit My Apparel?
So I stock a great brand called Kozak, and she basically just wants to design really lovely, beautiful cool, sexy clothes for women. And she works very closely with her factories in Portugal and Poland, and where she kind of they look at how they cut the fabric so there's no waste, how they can, you know, use waste if there is waste, and then the fabrics that she uses dead stock, she uses things like cupro, which is a byproduct of cotton, and I think that's important that there's a story also behind the clothes.
No, it's really interesting. We had an interview a couple of weeks ago with a brand called 4M, who are in Italia, London, Milan. That makes them sound very glamorous, but they're four sisters doing a clothing brand, and they, with their suppliers, they go to the supplier's factory and they watch them cutting the cloth and help them choose it, and they, you know, they have that full visibility of what they're doing, and it's that very much that hands-on, isn't it, you know, that you can touch and feel what's happening rather than it being in some, you know, remote warehouse or factory that you've no idea.
Well, exactly. If you can't see it, you don't know what's going on, and therefore you don't have that kind of guilt, or, you know, it just, I always say it's your, you know, people's moral compass to not understand where things are made. But the brands that I stock, you know, I stock a British brand called Beaumont Organic that are based down in Manchester, you know, and they have their production in Portugal. And again, very hands-on, goes to the factories, knows where the fabric comes from, how they can minimize waste, plastic free. And it's just doing all those better things, and and not cutting corners in order to make a bigger margin, because, you know, at the end of the day, we all want growth, but I think it's about the stability of the growth. I've clearly been reading the donut economics, but it is all about,
it's balance, isn't it?
It's about the balance. You can still make money off things that are sustainable,
but everybody needs to share in that money. It doesn't need to go in one person's pocket, you know. It can go into the factory workers, owners and suppliers, again, the whole supply chain. And interested to know what's your best-selling product that you have?
My best-selling product, probably jumpers.
Okay. It is winter, I suppose, in the UK.
I think people are shifting to this new organic cotton, because that's what you know, a lot of sustainable like platforms talk about at the moment. But also I think just down to people just want really good made clothes. I think people are coming back to quality again, you know, like it was back in the day where you pick something up and you could feel the weight of it. And I think people are sick of putting on a t-shirt and then within two washes, they've got like mini holes in it because of how the fabric has been made, because it's so thin, it's non-existent. So it will degrade in the washing machine.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a bit more money for a longer lasting product.
Absolutely. And that's how society is at the moment. You know, it's we want to see more for our money. So therefore, if that means buying four pairs of jeans in different colours rather than one, that's what people want to see at the moment, but they probably only wear two. So it's kind of like then that creates waste and clutter, and then you're going down the whole, well, where do I take my clothes to get recycled? It's a whole other ball game.
And as we discussed, when you do take your clothes to be recycled, the vast majority of those go to landfill anyway. So there's no point taking them.
Absolutely, because we don't have the machinery in place to pull the threads apart, because we don't. And again, this comes back to something else, is we don't know what the garment has been mixed with. And it takes time to kind of like, you know, pull it apart and turn it into something else.
It's a big issue, and as consumers, I think we can do make a certain difference with our buying habits. But as producers and manufacturers, there needs to be more responsibility on the entire life cycle, rather than once it leaves the factory, we have no responsibility for that object.
Well, I think a designer needs to start looking at the end of life first, and then work backwards. So I'm making this, but what happens to it when it's no more? Whether it's for one day or 100 days, you know, at the end of the day, it's how that is disposed.
Yeah, absolutely. So on My Apparel, you also do a Fashion Talks book club.
I do.
Tell us about that.
So out of the sheer lockdown, which lockdown? Lockdown one.
Yes.
I like reading books. I enjoy reading books. I like actually a physical book. And I just thought, well, I'm going to start reading all these books. I may as well just get people to kind of join in with me. Okay. And then I just thought, well, I have more questions to the book. And I thought, well, do you know what? Let's be cheeky and go and ask the authors if they wanted to kind of like answer a few more questions about the book and also the story behind the book. Why did you write this book in the first place? You know,
brilliant. And so how can listeners get involved in that? Just go to the site and sign up or?
Yeah, pretty much. So I've done season one, which is now finished, which was last year. So that was across 5 months. Okay. And that's available on my website and on YouTube channel. You can just go to myapparel.co.uk and click Fashion Talks and then they're all there. And I interviewed, I was so fortunate. I still believe that I managed to kind of like get everyone.
Yeah.
But lockdown helped.
I'm sure.
Nobody had anything to do.
Yeah.
So I interviewed Lucy Siegel for her book To Die For.
Yeah.
Tansy Hoskins for her new book Footwork, which again, she had a book. She had a book called Stitched Up about capitalism and fashion, and then she moved over to the footwear world, which again is equally, if not worse, than fashion. Elizabeth Klein, based in New York, with Overdressed, Safia Mini with her book Slave to Fashion, and Dana Thomas, reporter for the New York Times, for her Fashionopolis book. And I was just, yeah, so grateful that they could spare an hour just to kind of digging in more, really.
I mean, it's brilliant. I mean, I'm going to go and have a listen to and a watch of a couple of these, because we've had Lucy Siegel's book recommended a couple of times by different people. So it's been one I've been meaning to have a look at for a little while. But yeah, so that's really interesting. So listeners, go and have a look at that. That's great. So of all those books that you've seen and others that you've read yourself, what's kind of been the most interesting one that you've read?
Well, I think I will have to go for To Die For by Lucy Siegel. And you probably had that, like you just said, many times, but I think it's over 10 years old, this book.
Yeah,
That's not even including the research she did prior to that.
Yeah, so, yeah.
However, if anyone picks it up today, it's still relevant now because we've really not moved on that much from 10 years.
Absolutely.
So definitely that book. I think it's a really good starting place for people to kind of have that background. There's a lot in it. And but definitely, I think, if anyone wants to start off of knowing the background of fashion.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, well, we'll certainly put a link to Die For in the show page so people can go and check that out. So if listeners want to capture their crazy, sexy, cool style with Mia Apparel's effortless, sustainable brands, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Myapparel.co.uk is my website. And also, great. I'm on Instagram, which is myapparel.uk.
Okay. Great, and we'll put links to those social in the show notes, and we'll obviously be sharing those out on social as the show goes out. But for now, Kate, I want to say thank you so much for your time. It's been really interesting, and the shop looks great, the clothes look great, the selection looks amazing. If I was a lady, I would buy some.
Well, you know, that's what my husband says. He get annoyed because I've got a great brand called Langer Chen who do amazing coats, and he gets annoyed that I'm only stocking women's wear because he's like, I'd buy that coat.
Yeah.
So maybe one day, but we'll see. Great. We'll see if I grace over to the men's.
Brilliant. So thanks for now for joining us.
Thank you so much. That's really good. Thanks so much for having me. It's been great. So much more to say, isn't there?
So, a look at a couple of things behind the scenes now. And firstly, Clubhouse, we mentioned it a couple of times on the show, but coming up this week. Two shows to mention really on Clubhouse. One is on Thursday lunchtime at 12 o'clock, where we're discussing all things B Corps. So if you want to find out more about B Corps, get some advice, understand what it's about, find out the process, speak with other B Corps, then join us at 12 o'clock on Thursday. And on Friday, we have our sustainability news show. So if you've got a comment on anything we've discussed on the Green Elephant show, then join us on Friday, 1 o'clock, and we will be discussing the news. And why not bring us your own news? If you've got any news listeners or anything you want to talk about, join us on Clubhouse Friday, 1 o'clock.
And bring your own lunch.
You can bring your own lunch, although mute your microphone when you're chewing. That's fine. Coming up, and we've been working very hard in the background. It's B Corp month. So why don't you tell us what we're doing for B Corp month, Russell?
Well, this month, Mike, we, in a moment of madness,
partial madness,
suggested in the B Corp month meeting that we had that we launch 31 interviews with B Corps during the month of March. So we will be doing a show for every day of March 2021.
As well as the usual Green Elephant show, of course.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't want to miss that, would you?
No, I won't miss it.
And lo and behold, we're very close to filling the schedule now. We've got some interesting names, but we're not going to tell you who they are at the moment. And we've got companies from Australia, New Zealand. We are discussing with somebody in Canada, a couple in America, and obviously some in Scotland and some in England. And I'm chasing down an organic brewery in Belgium, which I'm really keen to go see. Go on a Zoom call with.
Yeah, no, that sounds great. So look out for that B Corp month interviews every day from the Green Elephant. And now it's my favourite time of the week, and Russell would be disappointed as once again we have a guest edition of Fact or Fake. And this week we have Kate Orgas from My Apparel. If you haven't listened to it already, listen to the interview earlier in the show. Got some really interesting bits in there. But since Kate is in the fashion field, we have a selection of fashion facts or fakes. Are you ready? Are you ready?
I am ready. I feel like I'm being put on the spot here.
Well, you are.
My God, she knows nothing.
Okay, so your first statement is, just 3% of the material used to produce clothing is recycled into new clothing at the end of life. Is that a fact or is it a fake? 3% of the material...
I think it's fake.
I think we had fact first. The unfortunate truth is it is a fake, because only 1% of the material used to produce clothing is actually recycled at the end.
I should have listened to my gut.
Right. Okay. let's try this next one. So a polyester shirt has double the carbon footprint of a cotton shirt. Is that a fact or is it a fake?
Fake.
And why do you think that's a fake?
Because of the process that cotton has to go through.
That's a good point, because the vast amounts of water used in making of cotton.
But it's a fake because it's a fact because of the fossil fuels that is derived from.
It is, absolutely. So it's 5.5 kilograms of CO2 versus 2.1 kilograms. So it's double for a polyester shirt. Okay.
I'm not doing very well here, am I?
Well, that's fine, because I always lose, so I'm happy for any victory. You're making me feel good.
brilliant.
So the ethical clothing market increased in value by 10% last year.
Fact. You're going to say fact?
I'm doing well, actually. The good news is that it is a fake, because it's growing much faster than that. It's 20% last year, 20% growth.
I knew it was growing.
So that's, I think that's good news, despite the fact that I got that one right again. But that's it. It's another fake. Number four.
Not really an expert, am I?
Well, as we said, it's about awareness of the issues more than anything else. Here's one. 60% of leading clothing retailers believe there was modern slavery going on somewhere in their supply chain. So 60% of leading retailers thought they had modern slavery going on in their supply chain.
Fake.
Because you're correct, by the way. It is a
fake. Ah, yes. Okay, that's right. Why is it fake? Well, I just think from sheer ignorance, if I'm honest with you. But
yeah, and it's closer to 80%. 80% thought. And why they don't do anything about it, I've no idea. But 80% of...
That's worse, the fact that there's more and they're not doing
77% thought that there was modern slavery going on. And you know, what are they doing about it? Who knows? But yeah, so quite a scary on that. And finally, in fact, I think this week, there are 2,000 different chemicals used in textile processing, yet only 16 are approved by the Environmental Protection Agency.
Fact.
It is sadly a fact. So a rally at the end, but it's scary to think that of the 2,000 different chemicals, only 16 are approved for use.
You know, there's a great documentary called Stink, and it showcases his daughter got some pajamas and they smelt, and he was like, why did they smell funny? And he went through the process in America, and it's a really, really good documentary to understand what has been put onto textile products.
Oh, well, we'll look that one up. But in the meantime, thanks, Kate. And Fact or Fake for this week. And finally, before we go, I enjoyed this one, Michelin. And if you do a search for Michelin, you just come up with lots of food, which is perhaps why the Michelin man became the Michelin man. I don't know. But it's launching construction on its first tyre recycling plant. And it's developed a patented technology to recover the carbon black oil, steel and gas from end-of-life tyres. It's going to support circular economy, and scrap tyres be collected directly from consumer premises now. I am looking forward to the day when the Michelin man turns up at my premises to change the tyres on my car. I'm going to have the stopwatch on, and I expect Formula One pit crew times.
7 seconds or below, it's the only thing that will count.
If it takes more than 7 seconds, I'm going to be severely disappointed.
I'll have to have a funky little thing to take off 4 or 5 nuts off the wheels each
day. So,
that's brilliant.
Michelin man visiting a car near you.
I think it's quite good. The plant will be able to recycle 30,000 tons of earth mover tyres. Those are the monsters. No car tyre. I love that.
Yeah, change one of those in 7 seconds.
without crushing anybody or causing any serious injury.
Brilliant, yeah. So, as always, if you've enjoyed the show, please do go and visit the show page at greenelephant.show. You can find links to all the stories we've discussed, instructions on how to find us on the usual podcast providers. So please do go and visit, review and subscribe, because it really helps us to continue to make the show and hopefully keep you entertained. So hopefully we'll see you at greenelephant.show, or you can find us on social at greenelipod. But until next time, thanks for listening, and we hope you have a sustainable week.